This is an ABC podcast.
Good morning and welcome to AM. I'm Sabra Lane. On today's program, does the federal election have a sleaze problem? More candidates forced to answer pleas explains over strip clubs, anti-Muslim rants and giving preferences to anti-Semites. And good news for people concerned about a planned major development on the site of the Bali bombings. There are now signs it won't go ahead, with an Australian consortium looking to buy it.
I've had an assurance from the Indonesian consul late yesterday afternoon that there's going to be nothing done on the site until after we complete negotiations with the owner.
Armoured government vehicles have ploughed into opposition protesters in Venezuela after the opposition leader called for an armed uprising against President Nicolas Maduro. Juan Guaido has described himself as interim president since January after sham elections and has been backed by dozens of countries, including the US and Australia. In a VO message flanked by soldiers, he says the definitive end of the usurpation starts today in what the Maduro administration has called an attempted coup. Washington correspondent Zoe Daniel reports.
Live fire on the streets of Caracas. There have been dramatic scenes as masked protesters faced off with pro-government troops. Rocks and bricks have been thrown, water cannons and tear gas deployed, and armed military vehicles have ploughed into crowds of opposition supporters. Some members of the military have defected to support Juan Guaido, who made a public statement from a military base flanked by soldiers. But it's unclear how deep Guaido's military support runs. He's called on the armed forces to rise up against the Maduro government before, but the setting this time is different. He was flanked by high-profile opposition activist Leopoldo Lopez, released from house arrest, presumably by sympathetic guards. National guardsmen wearing blue armbands marking their support for him are out on the streets. Juan Guaido's representative in Washington, Carlos Vecchio, told me the opposition movement will succeed.
We have been on the streets since January. We will continue to doing that. And President Guaido has activated the Operación Libertad, the Freedom Operation, and that will continue through the hours and days. So it's not, again, it's not a single event. If they arrest Juan Guaido, the people of Venezuela will stay on the streets. So the majority of Venezuela are looking for a change, and that change will come. They won't be able to stop it. I mean, in my view, Maduro is the past. He's not governing. He's surviving in power. He's not able to provide water, electricity to our people. So it's a matter of time.
The Venezuelan military has put down coups before. Do you think that Juan Guaido has enough support within the military to make this happen?
He has a strong support from the people and the military force. The majority of them, they are Venezuelans. They are not aliens. They are suffering the same thing that ordinary people are suffering. And at the end of the day, they will be with us, supporting our constitution and this transitional process.
More than 60 countries have backed Guaido as interim leader, including Australia and the United States, which has thrown its wholehearted support behind today's action.
I hope this is enough to tip Maduro out of power.
National Security Advisor John Bolton.
The president wants to see a peaceful transfer of power from Maduro to Guaido.
The Maduro administration says it's moving to put down a coup attempt by a group of traitors and continues to have the support of the military, which it says is operating normally. Juan Guaido has urged people to stay on the streets to maintain momentum for change. In Washington, this is Zoe Daniel reporting for AM.
Patricia Leah is the Bloomberg bureau chief in Caracas and was on the streets of the city earlier today. She's told AM's Nick Grimm that events turned violent after the opposition leader Juan Guaido called for a military uprising.
Very large crowds have gathered outside a military airport in Caracas called La Carlota. The events turned more and more violent towards noon, where you saw massive amounts of tear gas and high-powered water hoses being used to disperse growing crowds. There were protesters throwing rocks and Molotov cocktails inside this military airport there in central Caracas. And then you would see the armored cars roll by, throwing canisters of tear gas back at the protesters. So it would just be just back and forth. The protesters would come back once the tear gas had dissipated, and then, you know, it happened once and again and again and again. But it was becoming increasingly violent. I think the intent of Guaidó was to march towards the presidential palace in western Caracas. But he was stopped along the way by armored cars, and he didn't make it there in the end.
And of course, this standoff has lasted so long. What is the sense there in Caracas that this is reaching its endpoint?
So I think today's was a very risky bet for Guaidó, right? I think it could have turned out two ways, right? Guaidó could have ended the day as the president, as holding his seat at the presidential palace in Caracas. Or he could end up in prison or exiled. We have to see, you know, what measures Maduro will take against him. But definitely, if this fails, as it seems like it will at this moment, of course, the situation is still very fluid and a lot could happen. I think it's going to be very deflating for the opposition, right? Because it reinforces the idea that Maduro still controls the majority of the armed forces in Venezuela, and that this one last-ditch effort didn't turn out as well as expected. Like right now, it seems like a failed attempt, but we have to be very mindful of the next couple of hours. The crowds are still there. They have thinned out, but they're still there, and there's still a lot of tear gas being used to disperse the crowds. But so far, 9 hours since Guaidó called for the people to protest, there's not much to show for, let's just say.
And that's Patricia Leia, the Bloomberg bureau chief in Caracas, and she was speaking with Nick Grimm. Sleaze, tears and accusations of intolerance, yeah? It's another day on the federal election campaign trail, with 2.5 weeks to go to polling day. The culprits in today's mudslinging? The extreme ends of the political spectrum and the influence they're having in what's shaping up as a closely fought contest between the major parties. Here's political reporter Tom Eagledon.
An anti-Muslim tirade from Liberal candidate Jeremy Hearn is the latest low point in a campaign rapidly headed for the gutter. In an online post last year revealed by Melbourne's Herald Sun newspaper, he accused Muslims of planning a revolution to replace the government with Sharia law.
No oath of allegiance from a person following such an ideology can or should be accepted by the Australian government under the current law. They are clearly people of bad character.
The Liberal Party must sack Jeremy Hearn as an endorsed candidate immediately. Refusing to sack him is incredibly weak. And frankly, how can Scott Morrison excuse this?
That's Labor member and Shadow Attorney General Mark Dreyfus, who's battling Jeremy Hearn for the southeast Melbourne seat of Isaacs. He says Mr. Hearn's words are offensive to all Australians.
They should have no place in a mainstream political party.
Mr. Hearn has issued a statement saying that these views don't reflect his views and he's apologised for them unreservedly. Shouldn't that be enough to move on now?
No. Jeremy Hearn is an Islamophobe. His comments are hate speech and they are abhorrent. An apology is not enough.
But Labor's had problems of its own in the neighbouring Liberal-held seat of Goldstein. It was forced to pulp How to Vote cards after preferencing independent John Tiger Casely ahead of the Liberal member Tim Wilson. A former One Nation supporter, Mr. Casely heads a group which believes Jews are descended from lizards and control the world. James Patterson is a Liberal senator from Victoria.
There are actually views that are very easy to identify with a simple Google search. It would not have been hard at all for the Labor Party to do the due diligence. And they made a decision to put him above a candidate who's well-known, mainstream Liberal Party candidate like Tim Wilson.
And he says Labor's not followed through on its promise to pulp all how-to-vote cards.
Volunteers were sending me examples of the Labor Party panning out how-to-vote cards that still preferenced this extreme and wacky candidate. So at the very least, they've been very slow to get out a new how-to-vote card, if not deliberately continuing to hand out a how-to-vote card with an extreme candidate on it.
At the other end of the East Coast, yet another candidate's in trouble. The Cairns Post has published uploads from what it says is the Facebook page of One Nation's Ross McDonald, who's campaigning for the far north Queensland seat of Leichhardt. The since-deleted photos show him groping two female strip club workers in what appears to be bars in Thailand, along with a series of highly sexist remarks. Even before the latest scandal, One Nation leader Pauline Hanson was reduced to tears during an interview with Channel 9.
People are hoping, praying that I'm going to be the voice for them And I couple this shit all the time and I'm sick of it.
That's One Nation leader Pauline Hanson ending Tom Eagledon's report. A strange thing happened during Monday night's election debate in Perth. The opposition leader, Bill Shorten, declared it was impossible to put a dollar figure on a key plank of his climate change policy. The government leapt on the admission. But corporate Australia has been virtually silent, and experts believe it shows just how much the business community wants action on climate change. Liza Borello reports.
Reporters and government MPs have been pressuring the opposition leader Bill Shorten for weeks to say how much it will cost to meet Labor's target of reducing carbon emissions by 45% by 2030. During Monday night's leaders' debate, he offered a clear and possibly surprising answer.
This issue about give us one number, I don't think that's possible to do. What we need to do is understand that if you want to stop polluting the environment, you do have to spend some money.
Ray Wills is the Managing Director of Future Smart Strategies, a Perth-based company that makes money advising WA businesses on renewable energy and technology. He argues it's not necessary for Mr. Shorten to come up with a dollar figure.
Because the real question is, what will this be saving the economy? Because energy generation from renewables will be cheaper.
Bill Shorten's concession has been met with virtual silence from the business community. Ray Wills argues that's because corporate Australia knows emissions reductions are necessary.
For some businesses, they would be okay if it's delayed, but they're not going to complain if it's put upon them because they actually think it's the right thing to do. I think what we'll see from the mining majors over the next 12 months will be an increasing commitment to a whole range of sustainability outcomes. That's because the delivery of energy more cheaply through renewables means their operations are going to benefit from measures that also reduce their carbon footprint.
Tony Wood is the director of the energy program at the public policy think tank, the Grattan Institute. He believes Mr. Shorten's decision to confess he can't cost the policy could be a good strategy.
If he had tried to get some sophisticated modelling done, then we'd have just had an argument about the modelling, accuracy or otherwise. In some ways, I think what Labor's done has been much more sensible and saying, well, look, you know, this is a difficult task. It's not going to happen overnight. It's not going to be free. And, you know, I think that the intention of the strategy, I suspect, or the political strategy, is to claim the moral high ground on climate change.
Tony Wood believes the lack of noise from big businesses on the issue reflects the pressure they're under to act on climate change.
You know, they're already operating as though there was a carbon price anyway. So whether they're doing it or whether the competitors are doing it, it's becoming almost academic, and the real world is moving on, and these companies have recognised they want to be part of that. And if you can see where the future's going, then what sensible companies do, the race is to get there first. The race is not there to be at the back of the pack.
And that's the Grattan Institute's Tony Wood ending Eliza Borello's report. AM invited a number of businesses to talk about this, but they declined. AM also asked the Federal Environment Minister, Melissa Price, for an interview, but she was unavailable. In breaking news, the former Minneapolis police officer, Mohamed Noor, has been found guilty of third-degree murder and second-degree manslaughter over the shooting death of Australian Justine Damon Ruzcik. It's the first time a police officer in Minnesota has been convicted over an on-duty shooting, and we'll bring you more if we can before the program ends. Family violence has emerged as an election issue in a way that advocates say is unprecedented. Both sides are promising more money for the sector, but the bulk of the funding going towards crisis accommodation for victims and children. But an expert policy advisor in Victoria has warned that stable housing must also be provided for the perpetrators. She says if police can't keep track of them, the risk to their victims will only escalate. Charlotte King reports.
About twice a month, a small hotel in Victoria's Central Highlands, roughly 100 kilometres northwest of Melbourne, gets a call from police. The hotel owners, who would prefer not to be identified, have signed up to a partnership with police and a local welfare agency to provide emergency rooms for perpetrators of family violence.
Where they agreed to be contactable and potentially provide after-hours or emergency-type accommodation if required.
Trentham Sergeant Nathan Gardner says when police are called in, it's usually the perpetrator and not the victim who's forced to leave the home.
Some perpetrators can probably see it coming. Others, I guess they feel a bit aggrieved. From personal perspective, I just try and explain as best I can to the person that, you know, we're obligated to take some some action.
Historically, women and children have been the ones to flee violence, uprooting their lives in the process and often ending up homeless. In March, the Prime Minister, Scott Morrison, announced a further $328 million for better safe houses, frontline services and prevention.
These services together will ensure that we can continue the progress we are making.
The opposition leader, Bill Shorten, has promised to double that amount, with a $660 million commitment for women's refuges, support packages, legal fees and affordable housing.
We still hear people say, why didn't she leave? When the real question we should have asked is where could she have gone?
Both packages include $18 million for security measures like new locks and CCTV to keep women and children at home when it's safe to do so. But neither side says it'll dedicate funds towards stable housing for perpetrators.
We've said there aren't, but we're essentially doing nothing then to address the risk that they pose and that may in fact be escalated by them being out of home.
Elena Campbell is the Associate Research Director of the Centre for Innovative Justice in Melbourne. She's interviewed dozens of perpetrators and victims of family violence as part of research commissioned by the Victorian Government, and her report is about to be released.
Women will say, I'm just as scared because I don't know where he is, or I know he's homeless, he's living in his car, I feel terrible, I'm going to let him come home. So no one is suggesting for a minute that safe at home policies be reversed, but the missing piece of the puzzle has been any attention on, well, what do we do with these blokes when we pull them out?
Elena Campbell says accommodation for perpetrators is chronically underfunded.
It's very short term, very ad hoc. You've still got to look at the what does that mean for her.
And what does it mean?
It means potentially increased risk.
Domestic Violence Victoria's Alison McDonald says it's still unpalatable for the public to fund housing services for violent perpetrators. But she says the climate is right to have a closer look at the benefits for victims.
They can be a circuit breaker in terms of prevention of ongoing and further violence.
And that's Domestic Violence Victoria Policy Advisor Alison McDonald, ending that report from Charlotte King. You're listening to AM, where it's 17 past 8. In Indonesia, it appears the construction of a restaurant complex on the Sari nightclub site in Bali won't go ahead today as planned. Dozens of Australians were killed there when a car bomb exploded there in the 2002 bombings. Survivors have lobbied for years for a peace park to be established on the site as a memorial to the dead. David Napoli is the chairman of the Bali Peace Park Association, and he's speaking here with Samantha Donovan.
I've had an assurance from the Indonesian consul late yesterday afternoon that there's going to be nothing done on the site until after we complete negotiations with the owner.
So what's happened to stop that construction starting today?
Well, I made it very clear to the consul general the other day that if there's any activity or if construction starts on the site, then our ability to negotiate is and buy the site is over.
But the owner of the site has appeared pretty determined to go ahead with the development. What's his attitude to construction being stopped?
I might just correct you there. We're not sure who the owner is at the moment. There's a fairly recently his niece has now claimed to have been given the title to the property. What's changed? I'm not actually sure, but also in the note from the consul, the Indonesian consul in Perth, there seemed to be a softening of their position. And I think the Indonesian authorities are a little concerned about the attention that the project is getting, not only in Australia, but beyond.
And the possible effect it could have on tourism?
Given
the uncertainty about who actually owns the site, how confident can you be in this assurance from the Indonesian Consul General in WA that construction won't actually start today?
She's been quite supportive of the project, an enthusiastic supporter for some time now, and I've got a relationship with her where I don't think she would let me down. And I know that she's been speaking to the relevant authorities in Bali, and she's has received reassurances that from the relevant authorities that they've spoken to the owner and the construction won't be progressed.
Mr. Napoli, What's been the involvement of the Prime Minister, Scott Morrison, in these negotiations?
Well, he actually took time yesterday to spend a little bit of time with me and some of my colleagues on the association. And he said he made a commitment to help in any way he could and encouraged us to keep going. He did say that he was prepared to work with the Indonesian authorities to find a solution that satisfied all the parties involved.
And that's David Napoli, the chairman of the Bali Peace Park Association, and he was speaking there with our reporter, Samantha Donovan. Now, returning to our earlier story, the former Minneapolis police officer, Mohammed Noor, has been found guilty of third-degree murder and second-degree manslaughter over the shooting death of Australian Justine Damon Ruzcik. It's the first time a police officer in Minnesota has been convicted over an on-duty shooting. Now, our Washington correspondent, Connor Duffy, he has been covering the trial. He's there and he joins me now. Connor, explain the verdict. It sounds a little complex.
Yes, that's right. Good morning, Sabra. The verdict was read out live in court just a few minutes ago, and there were audible gasps of breath. I was sitting behind Justine Damon Ruzcik's fiancée, John Damon, about a metre behind him, and he was quite emotional. Mohammed Noor was cleared of the most serious charge, which was second-degree murder, but he was found guilty of third-degree murder and of manslaughter. So in terms of sentencing, it's effectively going to be the same result. He'll be looking at a sentencing window of about 10 to 15 years. And for the state of Minnesota, history has been made here. Mohammed Noor is the first police officer to be convicted for an on-duty shooting. And certainly there was relief and hugs from the family of Justine Damon Ruzcik, who appeared happy with the verdict.
Yeah, Connor, have they actually said anything? But they've been there for a lot of this hearing. Much of the evidence was quite distressing.
Yes, that's right. No, they haven't. They had to sit through multiple court hearings where they effectively watched Justine die over and over again. They also had the added factor of having to sit right next to Mohammed Noor's family. So just imagine if that was your daughter or fiance or sister and you had to watch her die right next, jammed in a tiny space next to the person's family who killed her. In the end, though, they did get what they would see as justice, and it was swift. Mohammed Noor was immediately handcuffed and led away from court to custody.
All right. Connor Duffy, thank you very much for that update. Japan begins a new era today with the ascension of a new emperor, but archaic rules mean there are fears the world's oldest continuous monarchy could perish. Crown Prince Naruhito will this morning accede the chrysanthemum throne after his father Akihito abdicated yesterday in an event that hasn't occurred in the country for more than 200 years. But his own wife won't be able to attend his enthronement, as our North Asia correspondent Jake Sturmer explains from Tokyo.
The Reiwa era, meaning peaceful harmony, has officially begun here in Japan, the world's oldest continuous monarchy. At a ceremony late yesterday, the outgoing Emperor Akihito offered his deep gratitude to the Japanese public.
Since ascending the throne 30 years ago, I've performed my duties as the emperor with a deep sense of trust in and respect for the people, and I consider myself most fortunate to have been able to do so. I sincerely thank the people who accepted and supported me in my role as the symbol of the state.
Crown Prince Naruhito is an Oxford-educated 59-year-old and will be the first Japanese emperor born after World War II. When he ascends, for the first time, a woman will be present, Prime Minister Shinzo Abe's only female cabinet minister. But women in the royal family, including his wife Masako, are not permitted to be in the room when he receives his sacred regalia, signifying his rightful succession. Masako and Naruhito have a daughter, but current laws mean she'll never inherit the throne. Only males can accede, and all successors must come from the male bloodline. Realistically, that leaves Naruhito's 53-year-old younger brother, Prince Fumihito, and his 12-year-old son, Hisahito. Yuji Otabe is an emeritus professor of Japanese history at Shizuoka University of Welfare.
For the imperial succession, the question is, will Prince Hisahito have a son? If Prince Hisahito doesn't have a son, the hereditary system will fade away and the whole emperor system will perish.
Masako, a former high-flying diplomat, has struggled for years with a stress-related illness since joining the tradition-heavy household. Some have put this down to the pressure of producing a male heir. Outside the Imperial Palace in Tokyo, many feel that the time is right to have a female emperor. Jun Maejima, who has a daughter, says as we're heading into a new era, he thinks it would be good to have a female emperor. Michika Nagae says she doesn't mind if it's a male or female, either's fine. She says it's a hard role and that it's best if there isn't too much noise and pressure placed on the females in the royal family. Whether the government will change the laws to allow a female to ascend the throne will be debated for years to come. In the meantime, it's a time for celebration here in Japan. The new emperor's enthronement forms part of an unprecedented 10 days of holiday in this workaholic culture. This is Jake Sturmer in Tokyo for AM.
A former Fairfax media high flyer and one-time newspaper copy boy, Anthony Catalano, has taken what could be the biggest gamble of his so far stellar career. He snapped up Fairfax Media's former regional assets for $115 million. Mr. Catalano is likely to become executive chairman of Australian Community Media, which has more than 160 mastheads, including the Newcastle Herald, the Illawarra Mercury and the Canberra Times. Nine Entertainment's just offloaded those assets. Anthony Catalano is speaking here with our senior business correspondent, Peter Ryan.
Look, I think the exciting thing about the ACM business is that it's diverse. It's got a massive audience of between 7 and 8 million people. So I think those two things alone make for an exciting opportunity to try and monetize it in a way that perhaps under the Fairfax management previously it wasn't able to because it wasn't the most significant asset in that group.
This is a pretty big bet for you, and there's a lot riding on you making a success of this, especially for your new staff.
Look, I think it's not dissimilar to other businesses that I've run. And we took a business that was in loss-making territory for Fairfax and turned it into a highly profitable business and then into the Domain float. So I think we've got a history of demonstrating that we can turn around old media and introduce some new media elements to it.
Australian Community Media has more than 160 titles and some prestigious ones like the Newcastle Herald, the Illawarra Mercury and the Canberra Times. So does this make you Australia's newest newspaper baron?
Look, there's certainly a lot of there's a lot of titles in there. There are, as you say, those very significant titles. The Canberra Times, probably the jewel in the crown. The Newcastle Herald, as you mentioned, the Illawarra Mercury, the Border Mail. The issue for those organisations has been that there were other bigger priorities, and it's in the face of very significant industry or structural decline in the newspaper business. So, the ACM business was probably at the bottom of the priority list.
As you say, ACM was pretty much sidelined in the bigger Fairfax than the Nine business and probably didn't get a lot of love. So is that going to change under your leadership?
Well, it'll effectively be my only child. So it's the only business in our group. So for us, it's our, it's our number one and only priority.
You're taking this on at a tough time for newspapers right around the world. But how many of those 160-plus mastheads will still be around in a few years' time, given the pressure to consolidate and to cut costs?
Look, the death of newspapers has been predicted for some time. I don't buy the story. For me, these businesses now require investment. They don't need to exist necessarily just in their, in their current form. The issue for us is to review how those subscription models have been put in place for some of these papers. The reality is the Border Mail, which covers the Wodonga and Albury area, is not going to be covered as well by papers like The Age, The Sydney Morning Herald, and so they become critically important.
Fairfax Media staff have been through years of job cuts, and regional papers have also been badly hurt. So can you guarantee that there'll be no new job cuts?
I think what I can guarantee is that there'll be a widespread review of all of the businesses effective. And, you know, I can guarantee you that, and I guarantee all the staff within the organisation that we will be doing our best to grow the business, not shrink it. You know, guarantees are a tough thing to give, but I haven't bought this business with an intention to shrink it.
What about Fairfax's charter of editorial independence that transferred to Nine? Will you sign on to that now, and does that transfer to the new business?
The papers are free to run their journalism as they see fit, and I won't be playing any role in directing the news content of the business.
That's Anthony Catalano, the new owner of Australian Community Media, speaking there with Peter Ryan. That's AM for today. Thanks for your company. I'm Sabra Lane.
There's a man whose words are all through the Mueller report.
White House counsel Don McGahn has now met extensively with Robert Mueller.
Don McGahn had a choice: help Donald Trump potentially commit a crime or resign. The curious story of history repeating itself.
There is no doubt that at one stage I realized that the best course for me to protect myself was to tell the truth.
That's this week on Russia If You're Listening. Available now on the ABC Listen app and wherever you get your podcasts.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.